we need to be very curious about the information that we receive, especially before we adopt it.
This is Choose to Be Curious, a show all about curiosity. We talk about research and theory, but mostly it's conversations about how curiosity shows up in work and life. I'm your host, Lynn Borton. Welcome. Come, choose to be curious with us. Today's conversation is a sort of Choose to Be Curious trifecta. A neuroscientist who studies empathy, has devoted himself to science communication, and willingly stands in the chaotic swirl where curiosity can go weirdly very awry. Ben Rhine, PhD, is a postdoctoral researcher in Dr. Robert Malenka's lab at Stanford University and a science communicator on social media. You might know him as Dr. Brain on TikTok or Instagram. He's the one summarizing research papers, teaching neuroscience basics, and debunking viral videos that promote scientific misinformation. I first became familiar with his work when I heard him speak in the Center for Brain Health event last fall, and I was hooked. Here was someone embodying curiosity in a very concrete way, following his own scientific curiosity, of course, but also focusing that attention on empathy, a big curiosity repository, and our ability to connect with one another, all while taking on the seductive and corrosive power of bad science and tenacious mythology, helping us each be more curious consumers of our science information diet. I'm not the only one to appreciate those efforts. Ben has earned recognition from the National Academies of Science, the Society of Neuroscience, and among others, a personal favorite, he's a recipient of science communication grant funds from the Mind Science Foundation and the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. I am really delighted to have Dr. Ben Rhine join me today. So welcome, Ben.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me and for that extremely lovely introduction. That was wonderful. I really appreciate that.
Well, I really appreciate the work that you're doing, and I'm very pleased to finally have you here. And so congratulations on all of that. Did you see any of this coming when you decided to study neuroscience?
No, definitely not. I have to say, my stumbling upon social media was indeed a stumble. It was not intentional. And that was what changed everything, really, because I was previously a traditional academic, you know, kind of within the walls of the ivory tower, you might say. And social media allowed me to kind of break out of that, something I never would have honestly chosen to do intentionally. But it just kind of happened. I had a video go viral on TikTok unintentionally. And I discovered that you could really reach a lot of people and touch a lot of people and improve science literacy and do all these amazing things in a place where you don't typically expect to see science. That was really, I don't know, really broadened my perspective. And here I am. So I'm really grateful for everything that's happened. It's definitely, you know, a lot of luck involved, but I'm just super, super pleased with the way everything's gone and just to be a voice of science to meet the public where they are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm interested in trying to thread the needle or balance whatever between that sort of social media part of your life, which feels like it, I know social media can get big and kind of all consuming, but you're also really a scientist, you know, at your core. So let's start with, what's a basic understanding of neuroscience that would help us, the general public, understand what's going on in your area of interest, empathy? I mean, what should we know there?
In empathy specifically or neuroscience broadly?
Well, why don't you start broadly and then narrow it down if that's an easy thing to do?
Yeah, sure. So I think a big distinction right off the bat is people often get tripped up between the difference between a neuroscientist and a neurologist. A neuroscientist is someone who works in a research lab, typically in an academic setting. These are your college professors, right? But after they are finished teaching your course, they go back to their lab where they have students and postdocs and technicians running experiments. And their focus is how the brain works, trying to unravel the mysteries that still remain very much active. Whereas a neurologist is the person you go to when you have a concussion or some sort of neurological condition. Right. So as a neuroscientist, I'm not a medical doctor, I'm a researcher. And where we're at as far as neuroscience is, I think there's a big misconception that we don't know much about the brain. You know, a lot of people say we only use 10% of our brain. There's a lot of myths. That one is particularly false. We certainly use 100% of the brain. And I think because of maybe the sort of portrayal that casts on neuroscience, where it's like, oh, there's a whole 90% mystery that we don't know, we don't use. It makes people think that we don't know a lot, but we really do know a lot about the brain. Mm-hmm. We've mapped every brain area. There's several hundred based on our current definition of the boundaries. And each brain area, we have at least some understanding of what it does. Scientists have shown that when you do a certain task, this brain area lights up and this brain area becomes less active, and all variations of that, going from humans to monkeys to fish, understanding the various levels of the brain that you can sort of ask questions at those different levels. You know, in a fish, you could start going deep into the neurotransmitter levels and looking at the expression of proteins in certain brain cells, because we can use a lot more invasive technologies than we can in humans. So there's a whole sort of spectrum of understanding of where we currently lie on the brain. And as you mentioned, my topic is empathy. So I'm studying, surprisingly, I'm studying empathy in mice. It seems like a topic that you might study in humans, and many people do. But like I mentioned, you have varying levels of resolution or specificity. And in mice, we can get to very deep levels of understanding of empathy to get to, you know, a circuit level, which brain cells are releasing which neurotransmitter onto other groups of brain cells, and how is that specifically involved in empathy? And if we shut that off, can we stop empathy? Things like that, where we can really get into these deep questions. Believe it or not, mice do show empathy. A lot of animals show empathy.
And do they show empathy in a way that translates well for humans? Or do we know that?
Yeah, there's a lot of like construct validity, I suppose, in the way we study empathy in mice. So, okay, let me ask you this, and sorry to paint this unfortunate picture, but if you watch someone experiencing something painful, like if you saw someone like accidentally slam their hand in a car door.
Yeah, cringe instantly.
Yes, right. And you become uncomfortable, right? It's like, oof, no thanks. I'm going to look away. It feels bad. That is empathy. Because your brain is empathizing with, you're sharing the experience with a person who's undergoing a very uncomfortable phenomenon. And so it's interesting because it's your brain trying to teach you through someone else's experience. That's sort of the evolutionary purpose of empathy, is it enables communication. It facilitates social learning in groups. And so by seeing a person get hurt, you can recognize, oof, I'm going to not do that because that looked like it hurt. So this exact example is sort of what we're studying in mice, where we'll have a mouse that's experiencing like arthritis in one of their paws, and their paw is inflamed. We put them in the little environment to interact with another mouse. And after they interact, the other mouse that was not experiencing any inflammation or anything, it just interacted with that mouse, the bystander will start to show like hypersensitivity and become like more cautious in guarding their paw. Oh, and they'll start to behave as if they're in pain. And this was discovered in the lab of Robert Malenka by a scientist named Monique Smith, who now has her own lab at UC San Diego. But it's called the social transfer of pain. And this is the model that we're using in mice to study empathy, because we've now established this really nicely controlled setup where we can have two mice interact for an hour or so, and then we can reliably observe this empathy phenomenon of the other mouse taking on the pain mouse's pain. And by having that nice structure, that behavioral assay, we would call it, we can then start to do all these other experimental manipulations and say, okay, well, what happens if we turn on this group of brain cells, or if we shut off this group of brain cells, or we give this drug, you know? And that's when we start to really dive into understanding, at least in that context, what's happening in the brain. So when you're seeing that person experience something painful and you cringe and you react, you know, we want to understand what are the real deep neurobiological circuits driving that experience.
And that's where I guess some of your interest in sort of empathy and social connection comes in, because that the empathic response is a social connective response, right?
That's right. Yep.
But you've also talked about, and I think you've done some research sort of looking at this, or looked at the research around this, about what happens when we don't feel a connection, where somebody's in pain. Can you speak to that? Because I actually think this is a really, really important area of work on this.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. So there's two sort of levels of this and gradients. I guess you can think of empathy as like a spectrum, where you might experience empathy to a really extreme level or a less extreme level, depending on who you're engaging with, whoever the person, the demonstrator is, the person demonstrating the emotion, whether it's pain or joy or sadness. So if you're very close with a person, like a sibling or a family, you know, relative, a close friend, you're much more likely to experience deep, powerful empathy towards them. But what's interesting is the on the other end of the spectrum, there are many factors that will drive you or anyone away from empathy. And generally, those factors are similarities or dissimilarities. So the brain is just naturally wired to empathize less with people who are less like us. And there's studies amazingly showing this where, or if you saw a group of people, a picture of a hand being poked with a needle that looks painful, and you put a cross or a Jewish star or some religious symbol just above this static image of a hand, the person watching that will show either more or less brain activity in empathy related areas if they identify or don't identify with that religious symbol. So if I'm Jewish and I see a hand being poked with a cross, there's actually going to be less reactive emotional empathy in my brain to that hand simply because there's a cross than if there was a Jewish star on it. And it's truly incredible when you think about the sort of implications of this, that in our modern society where we have polarization over just about everything, you know, politics is an easy one, but you have, you know, race, identity, there's gender identity. There's all these reasons for you to look at someone and say, I disagree with you, or I don't identify with the group you identify with. And we need to recognize that this is actually inclining our brains away from empathizing with each other and toward treating each other less with less humanity. And that's something that's really, like you said, I agree, it's very important, something that a lot of people don't know.
And this is the place where I hope that the role of curiosity and empathy become important. And I wonder if at any point where we're feeling or not feeling an empathic response and we get a little bit curious about that and try to maybe surface a bias. Is there science that tells us that we're capable of doing that? I mean, where does our being curious about our response come into this?
So I have a bit of a theory about this.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Theory. Because I unfortunately can't point to any clear, hard scientific data and say, here's what you do.
Yeah.
There's two elements of empathy. There's cognitive empathy and emotional empathy. Cognitive empathy is just simply understanding another person's situation, right? Like someone gets their hand slammed in a car door, you can look and say, that is pain. I recognize that this person is experiencing pain. That's cognitive empathy. Emotional empathy is that cringe, that reaction where you're taking on those emotions, you're sharing their experience. And they typically go hand in hand, you know, because you really can't experience emotional empathy without understanding first what they're experiencing. Even though you may not name it in your mind, you have to understand it first. So my sort of perspective is that cognitive empathy is easier to reach than emotional empathy. It's much easier to look and say, I know what they're experiencing, than it is to step into that and say, wow, I feel that too. And so my thought and my sort of theory is that if we can take a moment to appreciate and interrogate that cognitive empathy, we can sort of will ourselves into emotional empathy. You know, if you can, your brain may be less predisposed to just jumping to that, to sharing that emotion that they're displaying. But by looking and saying, okay, I understand that emotion. Let me try and really put myself in those shoes. What would that feel like for me? And you can just sort of, you know, this anecdotally, this is certainly possible. I've done this. You can just kind of walk yourself into it and say, wow, you know, that feels whatever it feels. It feels good. It feels bad. But although it may not be a natural immediate response, it's still something that you can reach potentially through intention.
Yeah. Well, to me, that's the thread, the through line, if you will, to your work in science communication, because I think you're pushing people to consider new information, new ideas, and change how they think about things. I mean, that's sort of your end goal, right? You're yeah. Nodding.
Definitely. Yeah.
So what sort of lessons have you learned about taking on people's kind of convictions and their curiosity and sort of turning them around? What have you learned that you can teach the rest of us? Holy cow.
I'm so glad that this is such a great question. I've never been asked this, and especially in the context that you've asked it coming off of that discussion we were just having. I've learned that you know, of course, anecdotally, I haven't published this, but being on TikTok, I've learned that you are never, ever going to convince someone to change their perspective or consider an alternative perspective by, you know, as the kids say, dunking on someone, you know, by being in their face, condescending, rude, you know, creating conflict, being hostile. That is not a way to get someone to change their mind. That will never work. But by doing the opposite, by approaching it with respect, with care, you know, treating them with respect, treating their opinion, their perspective with respect, saying, I understand why you would think this. And it does kind of make sense. But actually, when we look at the data, this is what we really see. By approaching it that way, you have such a greater potential for them to empathize with you and to see your perspective. Because like I just said, there's a million reasons someone could step away and disengage and not feel empathy and not share an experience or not share another person's perspective. And we don't want to trip up any of those. We don't want to hit any of those landmines. So by being caring and cautious and just trying to appear as a friend and not a foe, I think you can really broaden your reach and deepen your impact.
I think it's actually, I mean, I think there's an interesting question for the Academy in this, because you sort of began by saying, oh, I was, you know, definitely in the institution, you know, straight and narrow. But there's a lesson to be learned about the approachability of the informality of your communication style, of your science communication style. And what impresses me, one of the things that impresses me about what you do is that you manage to stay really serious in really serious content. And like, you're pulling up the studies and you're showing people where to find the studies, but you're doing it in this very TikTok-y, you know, casual way. That's kind of a pretty special alchemy right there. And I feel like it feeds a lot of different types of curiosity simultaneously. Is that intentional? I mean, have you been cultivating your style in that way, or?
No, I'm bad at marketing. And
I beg to differ.
Well, it's funny because what you're describing is something I only realized probably, I don't know, maybe a year or 2 years into it, that I was filming my videos, you know, holding my phone out in front of me, wearing a t-shirt in my, you know, with a empty wall behind me, basically doing the exact opposite of the way science has presented itself historically. You know, you think of a scientist, you think of a person in a laboratory in a white coat. They're probably old and white. You know, there's lab beakers and everything everywhere. You know, if you think about a presentation, like you go to a scientific talk, you know, they're up on a stage, they have complicated slides, they're wearing a suit. Like there's this sort of formality and this tone around science. And the way that I just naturally approached TikTok was, okay, I'm not at the lab, I'm at my house. I didn't even think about changing my clothes. I'm just going to keep wearing this t-shirt. I'm going to film myself. The quality is going to be extremely poor, because like I said, I'm not good at marketing. I didn't think about quality. And what came through is, you know, this person with deep knowledge about this area presenting it in a way that was completely non-traditional, with just, you know, no focus on like building an appearance or anything like that. And I think that was really instrumental in my early success on social media, but I didn't even realize it. It was just something I was doing.
Here's my bias. I see curiosity everywhere, right? But I also think it's got this interesting curiosity element for your audience, where, you know, we say, if you can't see it, you can't be it, right? And I think what you do is you create an on-ramp for people to go, oh, like I could be curious about this stuff, because here's a dude in a t-shirt rocking his chair, you know, talking about this stuff in a really interesting, very accessible way. And I think it has the potential, and I think your numbers suggest it's more than just potential, to ignite curiosity for people about science, about things that they're unfamiliar with, because you've given them this really easy on-ramp. And I know you've talked about the value of sort of inoculating for future false information. Could you speak to that? Because I think that's also a really interesting power of what is going on here.
Yeah, first off, I want to say I absolutely agree with you. I think, you know, it's exactly that. Being just on social media, you're swiping and there's a leopard chasing a car running 99 miles per hour. And then all of a sudden it's something kind of interesting about science. And before you know it, you're 15 seconds in, you're like, oh, this is kind of neat. And I just hope that that's exactly what it is. It ignites that curiosity that maybe people didn't know that they had and could translate into something tangible that they end up following. And they end up, you know, Googling some science questions and who knows what it turns into. But about your second question about inoculation, what you're referring to, for anyone who's not aware, is there's a lot of misinformation on social media, and there's sort of two approaches to rectifying that. You know, you can either inoculate, you could sort of prevent someone from being convinced by misinformation by pre-bunking something and inoculating them against that misinformation, or you can debunk it, where after it's already gone viral or whatever it's done, you pull it up and you say, let's talk about this. And then you kind of try to break it down and make it clear. I believe, as far as I've last seen, pre-bunking or inoculation is a more effective technique for getting people to not believe misinformation. But what's easiest for me to do on social media is debunking, where, you know, because I don't become aware of misinformation until it's suddenly viral and it pops up in my feed. And I'm like, holy cow, this is a really big problem. This video saying that whatever, do take this supplement, it's going to double the size of your brain and it has 10 million views. It's complete bogus. This is a problem. And so that's where I'll jump in and try to explain, like, you know, that would be an easy one where it's like, well, this isn't really possible. but usually it's a lot more complex and nuanced than that. And I really have to go and like you said, cite the literature, show my references and help the person understand that, you know, this is real science here on one side versus some random account that you can't even see their name because they're not trying to put their face out there because they're spreading misinformation and they don't want to be tied to it.
So that raises a really interesting question. If pre-bunking is really effective, more effective than trying to catch up after the fact, are there curiosity practices that we could and should be using that would help us pre-bunk ourselves?
Yes, I think that you sort of can't avoid being online these days without coming into contact with some, you know, piece of information. And that could be misinformation. It could be true. You're always coming into contact with theories and ideas. And I think we all need to be curious about, well, what's the history of this claim? You know, if I Google this claim, what's going to come up? Am I going to find PubMed scientific article, or am I going to find a Reddit post or some, you know, deep blog that I've never heard of before? I think we need to be very curious about the information that we receive, especially before we adopt it. That's the critical part. Is it's very easy to see a TikTok video. And of course, you know, the reason those videos are going viral is because they're so compelling. It's so timely and you're just so engaged. And it's super easy to then, a month later, you're in a conversation, the topic comes up and you're like, oh, I heard something about this. And then you start talking about it. You're like, I actually can't remember where I read this. Truth is, you saw it on TikTok through a random person a month ago, but you never took the time to validate that information. And as a result, it's accidentally slipped into your sort of, maybe not your worldview, but at least your perspective, where you bring it up in conversation and then you could be propagating the misinformation. So we definitely need to be cautious about integrating information, especially in the current culture where you have to recognize that every single person on social media is incentivized by the possibility of going viral. And the way you go viral is to be interesting and share something captivating. And 9 times out of 10, something that someone makes up is more interesting than the truth, which is usually nuanced and complicated and uncertain. Just know that when you see anything on social media, there's very likely a person behind it who's trying to get more views. There's always that element that you need to be considering.
Yeah. Okay. I have a curiosity practice I want you to join me with. Are you game for my big jar of wannabe analogies?
Of course I am.
Okay.
I don't know if I have a choice.
Well, I like to think you do, but okay. So this is my big jar, literal big jar. I'm going to take out 3 slips of paper, one for you, one for me, and one for the audience. And we're going to make an analogy to curiosity with whatever is on these slips. Yours is hiking stick. How is curiosity like a hiking stick? And mine is bandage. You want to go first or you want me to give it a shot?
I can go first because immediately something came to mind.
Oh, good.
You know, I think actually when you frame a hiking stick as an element of curiosity, it actually fits quite well because you're sort of probing what's next, right? You're exploring the ground in front of you. You see a pile of leaves. You're curious. Is there a hole beneath that pile of leaves, or is there a rock, or is there water? And so, you know, by using a hiking stick, you're creating opportunities for curiosity. You're also kind of expanding your senses in a way because you're creating like another ground point. But I think curiosity is, you know, it's a desire to know more. It's a desire to search for more information. And that's actually exactly what a hiking stick does for you when you're walking.
Nice. Very nice. Okay. Bandage. Yikes.
Good luck with that one.
I know, right? Okay. So how is curiosity like a bandage? Bandages are, I mean, they're actually something that we use when we're in pain, or I mean, speaking of pain and injuries and things, and they can help us get past that pain and that injury. And I think curiosity can do the same thing. It can help us get past feeling banged up and maybe staunch the bleeding. And it's actually an interesting thing to think about curiosity in that way.
It is. It's almost like curiosity can protect you from, like we were just in the context of misinformation, right? You see some information, curiosity can protect you from believing something that is false, just like a bandage can protect you from reopening a wound.
Yeah. Thank you.
If you think of misinformation as a wound.
Really? Seriously, it is. I think that's a great analogy. And audience, yours is zipline. How is curiosity like a zipline? Let me know, social media, hashtag analogy. Well, Ben, thank you so much for this. What fun, and thank you for what you're doing out there on behalf of science information.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has really been a great conversation. And that analogy exercise is a good one. That'll definitely get you thinking.
You've been listening to Choose to be Curious. I'm your host, Lynn Borton. Thanks for joining us here today. You can find all my shows on my website at choosetobecurious.com. I hope you'll follow me here, there, and on social media at Choose to be Curious, where you can share your zipline analogy, hashtag analogy. Many thanks to my guest, Dr. Ben Rhine. Links to all his various platforms on my website. Links, too, to the Center for Brain Health. Thanks, too, to Sean Ballack for our theme music. This is Perspiration by the Balloonists via Blue Dot Sessions. I hope you'll join us again next time. And until then, choose to be curious.